Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author.
Today's investors expect more than a transaction. They want a relationship. Show how your firm merges EQ and IQ with Orion's BFI 20, a new shareable assessment developed by Dr. Daniel Crosby that provides you with emotional and attitudinal insights into clients to facilitate more meaningful investing conversations from day one. Get started today at orion.com/BFI20.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I'm joined by Brendan Fraser, host of the excellent podcast, The Human Side of Money, and a champion of financial psychology like no one else. He's also a huge St. Louis Cardinals fan, which is why we're starting 40 minutes late, because we've been griping about the pitching staff. Well, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Good to be here. It's good to have somebody else that I can vent my frustrations to. Also, as a big fan and longtime listener of this podcast, it's always fun to come on here. And we basically just recorded a podcast episode before this, but we've got even more things to talk about, so I'm excited.
Yeah, we should collaborate on a Cardinals gripe session podcast. They've given us plenty to gripe about, but we're not going to talk about that today. We are going to talk about these sort of 10, you are like the Martin Luther of financial psychology. You have posted your 10 theses up on the church wall. These are your sort of your 10 rallying cries for the human side of money. And it's just fantastic. And I want to talk about your 10 principles today. So we're going to jump right in. The first of these is that goals shift and values persist. This is something I believe in deeply. It's something we're working on at Orion. Tell us what you mean by this. And then also, how do we move from illuminating values to tying those back to specific goals?
But I want to zoom back out for a second, add some context just really quick on what my thought process was behind doing this, right? So from the very beginning, when I started out, it was the idea was, hey, let's try to make this human aspect, the behavior, the psychology, these communication principles, let's try to make it as applicable as possible for advisors to be able to use day in and day out, right? Like, and the classic example is, I don't want to diagnose somebody with a bias. I want to know what to do about it, right? Let's bridge this gap between education and application. That was the mission. That's what sparked this whole thing, to make it as easy as possible. Well, fast forward to doing the episode, doing some research on my own, doing the podcast, interviewing all these great people. And I kept hearing from a few different people here and there, like, hey, like what you're doing, like the podcast, learn a lot, take lots of notes. You're hanging out with me and my dog on walks in the mornings. But it would always be like, but sometimes I just get a little bit stuck with like all the ideas that I take away with, and I need to know what to do about it. And that was the last thing that I ever wanted to have happen, was somebody goes, hey, I'm not implementing and I'm not applying. So my idea was, okay, well, I'm going to sit down. By the way, this took way longer than I want to admit. But my idea was, okay, I've had these conversations. There's got to be some common themes that have been intertwined through all these. So the focus was, what are the 10 things that advisors could take and apply tomorrow that make the biggest impact? So sure, we could say, hey, here are 60 things that you can do to improve the behavioral, psychological, communication components of your practice. But nobody's going to do all 60. So the idea became, what are the 10 that are the easiest to do that can have the biggest impact on clients and on your practice? So just to give a little context around where this came from, that was the thought process behind it. So back to what you said, the values, goals shift and values persist. So the concept, I think, is that the way I try to describe it is, I say that behind every what is a why. And when I say that, when we think about it in the financial planning context, what most advisors do a really, really good job of, a great job of, in fact, is finding out what's important to clients. And we call those goals. A goal is something that is what is important to somebody. For example, classic example, what somebody wants to do is retire at 65. And that's their goal. And that's good. It's good. You want to be able to find out what people want to do. But we have to remember that behind every what is a why. And so when you dive in a little bit deeper, what you realize is, well, actually, let me back up and say this first. So you, generally speaking, we find out what somebody wants to do. I want to retire at 65. And then from there, you go, okay, great. The next step is, I've got the exact plan, the map to get you there. And that's generally financial advice, how it flows. What do you want to do? Perfect. Here's the plan to get there. What I think we need to move more towards, or the mindset needs to shift, is towards this idea that behind every goal, behind every what, is a why. And if you want to think about what are whys are essentially values, their purpose, their meaning. What is it that's driving that goal? And what you find out when you start going down that path and opening those doors is it's never really actually about retiring at 65. It's more about, why is it that you're retiring? Well, I'm retiring because I'm 62. My dad passed away when he was 66, got robbed of a lot of quality time with our family. I want to make sure that doesn't happen. I want to maximize the time that I have left and spend it with my family. So on the surface, what you see is a goal of retiring at 65. Behind every what, behind every goal is a why. There's something more behind it. And when you uncover those things, like the fact that it's about retiring, or it's about maximizing time spent with family, that's where the emotional connections are made. That's where motivation's created when somebody's trying to implement the things that they're supposed to do. And the best part about it is that once you know that it's actually about maximizing time spent with family, then you can start coming up with other whats or other goals to do that. Okay, so you're going to retire. What else would it look like to spend time with your family? What else would it look like to maximize time with your family? You're helping them create even more ways to live out what's most important in their life.
Yeah, I love that. Every what has a why. And like you said, when you uncover that why, that's where the behavior lies. That's where the motivation lies. That's the rocket fuel that's going to get them past all the hard stuff they need to do to get there. Love it. Yeah. The second one is that asking great questions is a superpower. Now, you just did a fantastic episode. Your podcast is really great. You just had a wonderful episode with an expert in asking great questions. I thought I had a niche job, right? Like, it seems like guys like me and you have a niche job. A question expert is perhaps even more niche. What was the most interesting thing you learned when talking with him about asking great questions?
Yeah, Warren Berger, he's a questionologist. That's kind of what he's labeled himself, which, yeah, as a self-admitted lover of questions and quite all things questions in general, I know it's weird, oddly passionate about it, can't help it, but I do admit it. I don't have a problem. Well, maybe I do have a problem, but I at least admit it. That's one that I looked forward to for a long time. Now, you talk about being nervous about prepping for a conversation. I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, what questions am I going to ask the expert on questions, right? So that was an interesting dynamic. The one thing I learned is that I tried to apply it for an apprenticeship on questionology. I basically said, hey, if you ever need an apprentice, can I be your guy? I threw it out there twice and he didn't take the bait. So my dream in that regard has been crushed. And he didn't even play along at all. But that's okay. But yeah, there was a lot that I learned. We talked for about an hour and a half and I felt like it should have gone even longer, could have gone even longer. But there's two things that really stuck out. One, and this is a concept that I learned a little bit probably about a year ago, but he really hit it home. And it's the idea that anytime you're worried about asking a question, or you have a question that you want to ask, you know that you should ask, but you're a little bit nervous about how it's going to be received. If you explain or give your rationale for why you're asking the question and tell somebody, hey, here's why I'm asking what I'm going to ask, then it paves the way to ask pretty much anything that you want to ask. And you can do it before you ask, or you can do it after. You can say, hey, we believe that money is a tool to fund the life you want to live. And so I want to ask you, what's important about money to you? Or you can say, hey, I want to know what's important about money to you, because what we believe is that money is a tool to fund the life you want to live. And in order to do that, we need to know what is important to you. And so you're saying, hey, let me explain to you why I'm asking the questions. You'll be amazed at how, once somebody knows why you're asking it, how much more they open up to actually answer it. And then the second thing was something that I've been passionate about for a long time. And the way he put it was, there are certain questions where we need to reframe our expectations. For example, you walk into the store or an office, the break room at your office, and you ask somebody, hey, how's it going? How was the weekend? How was your day? We tend to ask, he calls them rote questions, but these are questions that if we ask, we should not expect to get a good answer from. Like, if you're expecting to ask, hey, how was your weekend? And the person opens up and they say, oh, it was great. We did all these awesome things. My wife and I really connected. We got to spend some quality time with the kids. It was our dream weekend. That's probably not going to happen, because the way that you ask it, you're asking for a response that sounds something like this. It was good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And so like the same thing goes for and when you have kids, it's like, you're not, maybe the kids aren't open up. It's hard to get them to talk. Well, are you asking questions that actually deserve or should they're encouraging a response? He calls them rote questions, but it was this idea that there are certain questions that we ask that we need to reframe our expectations of what we're going to get out of them.
So we've at the dinner table, we've gone to what was the best or worst part of your day?
Yeah.
Instead of how was your day? Uh-huh. Because if you ask a teenager how was your day, I mean, you talk about some lame answers.
Yeah.
If you talk about getting stonewalled, ask a teenager or a pre-adolescent about their day, and you're gonna get some one word, some lameness. So we've had such better conversations by asking better questions. And you know, the thing that I love about your first comment there, it really goes back to why. You know, it really goes back to why. When someone knows the why behind their question, they don't read malintent or nosiness or whatever into it. So there's a great, I got to take a minute to break down a psychological study. There's a great psychological study from 50 or 60 years ago that looked at people in lines. I think it was in-
I was going to mention this too. It's, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. To make a copy, right?
Yeah.
People are in line to make a copy. And if you say, hey, can I cut the line? It's about 60% of people let you cut the line. If you say, hey, can I cut the line because I'm in a hurry to make it to my daughter's softball game. She's the starting pitcher and I really can't wait to see her, you know, do her thing. Then it's like 97% of people, I think, let you cut the line because there's a why behind it. But then they did a third condition, and this is where it gets really fascinating.
Yeah.
In the third condition, they say, hey, can I cut the line because I need to make some copies? Now, think about that. That's nonsense. Of course, like everybody's standing here, we all need to make copies. And yet the compliance is identical to the legitimate why. Whether you're going to see your kid, whether the why you give is going to see your kid in a softball game, or the why you give is I need to make some copies, people are just looking for context. They're looking for a reason. Even if it's a bogus reason, it's still powerful.
Yeah, that's in, I think, the Influence book by Cialdini. Jonah Berger just wrote a book called Magic Words, where he references it in there. And I think, I could be mistaken, I'm not positive on this, but I think even using the word because was a powerful force. So, like, using the word because to explain your why, and that was like the bridge to explain it, and that was a big indicator with the compliance. But yeah, the fact that you could, doesn't matter what you say, it was just the fact that you had a reason. And that led to compliance. I'm glad you brought up. It's the exact same principle that applies. You say you have a question to ask. As long as you have a reason for it, people will comply. They'll go with it. They'll trust that you're doing it for a reason.
All right. One and two were all about why. Number three is, well, kind of about why too. The more vivid your future, the more likely the behavior change. We're famously divorced from our future selves. You know, I read a book recently. I'm blanking on the reference, but I read a book recently that said, you know, we think about our future selves largely the same way we think about a stranger, right? How do we make our future selves known to us, and how do we make that future more vivid?
Yeah, this is always a fun one. I had Hal Hirschfield on the podcast, I guess, 6 months ago or so, a while back. He's like the future self guy, right? And so we talked about that same exact concept that you see your future self as nothing more than a stranger. And we started talking about how the reality is, if that's the case, then if you're thinking, hey, I need to start saving for my future self, so I can retire in 20 or 30 years, your ability, your desire to do that is about the same as if your ability and desire to go save for your neighbor down the street who you've never met's retirement, right? Because that's essentially a stranger. And we think that we're closer to our future selves than we really are. So there's a number of ways to do that. There's technology out there that helps do it, right? You can do face aging technology, so you see yourself as being older. There's been some studies done around that. There's storyboards, there's vision boards. Ted Klontz has done great research around that. But if we're thinking, again, the whole idea here was, what are the most practical ways you can take and use this tomorrow to make a big impact and a big difference in the lives of your clients. Those are all great and helpful, but I could be wrong, but I imagine most advisors would listen and go, okay, well, I'm not going to create a storyboard tomorrow with my clients. I definitely don't have any face aging technology that I'm going to use, but what can you do? Well, you can take their goals and add details. So you can take vague goals and turn vague goals into vivid visions, right? So back to the goal of retiring at 65, and I use that just because it's one that's so common in the industry. We could use this with any goal, but retiring at 65. So it's not a vague goal, would be retiring at 65. But do you want to turn that into a vivid vision that would be something more like, when I retire, we're going to go to Disney World with our family twice per year. We're going to stay at the Swan and Dolphin Hotel. We'll visit all four of the theme parks. After we go to the theme park, we'll come back home. Each member of the family will make their favorite dish for the rest of the family one night. Then we'll eat out the other nights. And after the grandkids go to bed, we want to sit around and play games and have game night, just like we used to do when they were our kids, when our kids were younger. And now it's all of a sudden, it's like, we're not talking about retiring at 65. We're talking about this very vivid vision of what you're going to be doing. And I don't even have to explain it. You can hear the difference that that's going to have in terms of getting somebody tied to the goal, getting them the motivation and desire they need to do the things that they're going to do. Tell me that I need to save X amount a month to retire at 65. I may or may not do it, but tell me that I need to save X amount a month so that I can fulfill this vision that I have. And I'm not going to waste a minute. I'm going to do it as soon as we're done talking. And so that's the idea, is getting from a vague goal to a vivid vision that has more clarity around what you're going to be doing, who you're going to be doing it with, how you're going to be spending your time.
Yeah, absolutely. So number four is, we love to hear our words repeated back to us. And this sort of reflective listening is a common, you're going to learn this in any sort of communication course. But I feel like sometimes we take it too far, and it can become like parroting. How can we take advantage of this truth? We do know that people like to be heard and understood and have these words reflected back to them. How can we do this in a way that doesn't feel clownish or sort of like parroting?
Yeah. So are you familiar with the waiter study around me? All right. Well, I know I assume that you know all of these studies, so I just had to check. Yeah. So they did a study with waiters and waitresses where they would go and they would take an order, and one group of waiters and waitresses would take somebody's order. And what they would do is they would praise the order. Right. So they'd say, "Hey, I want a cheeseburger with no tomato and fries." And they'd go, "Oh, that's great. You're going to love it. Our cheeseburger is awesome." They had a second group of waiters and waitresses that all they did was they repeated back the order to the customer. So they say, "I want a cheeseburger, no tomatoes with fries." And they go, "Okay, cheeseburger, no tomatoes, fries. Got it." And that the second group that just simply repeated back what they heard saw a 70% increase in the amount of tips that they got over the group that praised the order, that said, "Hey, you're brilliant, you're smart, what a great order." And to me, that's fascinating. It just speaks to how powerful it is for the brain to hear its own words repeated back. So the one way that you do that without parroting, without like asking questions or summarizing, is you take the language that you hear your clients use, and then use it both in that conversation, but also in conversations moving forward. So for example, it's not about retirement. I mean, it is, again, it's always about retirement. But when you're meeting with somebody and they say, "Hey, you know, what I'm really looking forward to is being able to spend some time on the beach with my feet in the sand and a drink in my hand. That's what I think of as retirement." Well, you better believe that from that point moving forward, if you use the word retirement, that's not going to mean the same thing as saying, "Hey, let's start working towards getting you to the beach with your feet in the sand and a drink in your hand," right? And you start, but the thing is, you have to document the language in order to be able to do that. But that's a much more powerful way to A, bring back up what you're talking about, B, make it vivid, and then C, if you say that 3 months, 6 months, 12 months down the line, I can promise you that person's going to go, "Wow, Daniel really listened to me. I feel heard." They may not think this consciously, right? But they're going to go, "I feel heard and understood. How could he remember that 12 months later?"
So I love it. It's so simple, but it's so brilliant, right? And that study, I was not familiar with that study, and it's a fantastic one. When I was in clinical practice, sometimes the folks that I would work with would sort of personify something they were going through, right? Like they would refer to, you know, depression as the beast or something like that. And then that would become our shorthand for talking about their depression going forward. And it was such a powerful thing, you know, to conceptualize it the way that they did and to show that you're listening. But like you said, if you're not taking notes, if you're not writing these things down, you're not going to have access to it. I love it. Really simple.
Yeah, that's another great example too, the beast, just because that means something to them. And so you're not having to read, you're not having to go back and start from scratch every time. You bring that up and they know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So number five is to send a discovery meeting recap email. Very tactical, very practical. Why is this so important and what should it look like?
Yeah, I don't know why exactly it's so important. Here's what I do know, is that it came up again and again and again and again. And it didn't just come up as an idea. It came up as a thing that these people, that, again, these are guests on the podcast, other advisors that do it. It came up as an idea that people do, that they use, that they didn't just say, hey, here's what I do. They would talk about it and then rave about it and explain how it was one of the most important steps in the whole process, right? And so, and like I hear it the first couple times, I'm like, yeah, it's interesting. That keeps coming up. Wow, they really love that too. And then it comes up a few more times. I'm like, all right, there must be something about this. There's this RIA out in Virginia where they have something similar to this. Just to clarify, by the way, this is an email that you send out, a recap email you send out after what you'd consider a discovery meeting where you're talking about things that are important to them in their lives. And I'll go into a little bit more detail here in a second. But what they found is that whenever they were tracking people that would go from a prospect to a client, and they found that one of the number one things they could tie back to that would predict whether they became a client or not was whether or not they received this recap email. And to me, that was also powerful. Like, are you serious? How is that possible? But I think the key to it is, A, you send it 24 to 48 hours. You should do it 24, but no more than 48 hours afterwards. But B, what it does is you're not just recapping like, hey, I heard you've got this much in your 401k, this much in your IRA, you want to retire at 65. You're recapping the things that they've told you are important to them, things that be, again, not their what, not just their what, but also their why. Why is it important? You're recapping, then you're using their language and their words in the email. So you would say, feet in the sand and a drink in your hand, like that's one of the things that's important to you. And what it does is it when you're sending something that says, hey, here's what I heard, let's make sure we're on the same page, here's what we do to move forward, and they hear these important things repeated back and their own language repeated back, is it basically says, like, wow, I feel heard and I feel understood in a way. This is like a day later, right? And they're going, wow, okay, they really captured that. They really got like what I was going for there. That's impressive. I even had an advisor who started doing it. And the first one he sent out, he got an email back from the lady that never emails back and said, I feel like you really get me. And like, yes, don't do this tomorrow and expect to get that email back. Like that's probably not going to happen. But like there's very few compliments out there better than, wow, I feel like, by the way, somebody that actually takes the time to email back to say, I feel like you get me, like that, I think that speaks to anecdotally the power that it has.
Well, there's so much magic in being gotten. You know, my first job out of grad school was doing pre-employment assessments of executives before this big bank would hire them. They would bring me in to do IQ tests, personality tests, half-day interview, this whole dog and pony. And then I would write up a report. And when someone reads their life kind of and their personality and their behavior sort of summarized back to them, I mean, they were putty in your hand. That's at that point. I mean, it sounds strange to say, but like you had their attention, and there was a magic that goes along with that understanding process that really made an impact on me early in my career. And, you know, whenever we're building technology, that's creating an assessment, anything like that. That's what I want the impact to be like, oh my gosh, like you helped me codify and put a name to something that I felt or experienced. And that's what I think that is all about.
Yeah. Wait, okay, hang on. Let me stick with this for just real quick, add to it. But I think about this a lot, that exact same thing when it comes to like the Enneagram assessment or the DISC assessment. Like you never feel better heard. You never feel more heard and understood than when you're hearing back your results from one of those assessments when it's dead on, right? You're like, yes, that's me. And you like can't get enough of it. I mean, go find the people out there. Like maybe it's Strength Finders, maybe it's DISC, maybe it's the Enneagram, but like people love that stuff because for some reason, when you get to hear back, like you can, like you said, codify, you can put a name to or an explanation to why you're doing what you're doing. You're like, man, I feel heard and I feel understood. That feels good. And even there's some things where you're like, no, that's not quite me, but you still get the clarity that that's not you. Right. And I don't know, there's something addictive about it.
Yeah, no, it's very addictive. And you know, life's so complicated. Our, you know, the mess going on between our ears is so complicated. When someone can listen to you and produce something that simplifies that mess between your ears, it's really powerful.
Yep. Yeah.
Number six, you changed up on me.
I did. Last minute curveball.
Talk to me about number six.
So, like I said, the filter for this, the focus of this is, what are the most 10 most important things that are easy to do tomorrow that make the biggest difference and the biggest impact? Well, as I was getting ready for so I presented this at the Shift conference, right? And as I'm getting ready for it, I'm just basically, this is my chance to go back and review and go, is there anything that's not in here that I think needs to be in here? And there's one that was a no doubt, this has to be in there. But the hard part was knowing what to take out. So then I went, should there be 11? No, 10 sounds better. So we'll consider this a bonus. So number six was two tools of the greatest communicators of all time, the best communicators of all time, tell great stories, and they use metaphors and analogies to explain and distill difficult, complex topics, right? So, but I don't think it's that easy to go walk into a meeting tomorrow and go, hey, I've got this great story and I've got this great metaphor and analogy. So it's not as immediately implementable, but it's still really important. So took that out after much thinking and debating and deliberating, and added what I call, or like, not what I call, what I've distilled down into client-inspired advice. In fact, that's what Tim Maurer calls it, client-inspired advice. And it's this idea that anytime you're giving advice, we're not going to go into this now because that'll take us way over, but like the least effective way to give advice is just to tell somebody what to do, right? Like, for a number of psychological reasons, giving somebody advice, telling what to do doesn't really work. But one of the biggest opportunities that I think advisors have that they overlook is the opportunity to connect their advice or connect their planning recommendations to purpose. So connecting planning and purpose, assuming that whenever you make a recommendation, that they don't know exactly why you're recommending it. So the example that I always use is, like, let's say you're going to recommend that somebody gets a revocable living trust. They're going to get, for estate planning purposes, they're going to set up a revocable living trust. I think sometimes we tend to assume that clients know why we're telling them to do that, and not just why legally, but why, tying it back to, like we said earlier, their values, their why, their purpose, right? And so most people would say, hey, we're recommending that you get a revocable living trust because it adds a little bit more administrative ease, allows us to control the assets, it avoids probate, right? And all those things are true. Technically, that's a great recommendation for all those reasons. But is that why they want a revocable trust? No, they want a revocable trust for different reasons. So instead, the flip side would be, you know, we're recommending a revocable trust because it's going to make it easier to take care of your granddaughter and provide for her without spoiling her, right? And it's like all the same things, just in a way that makes sense to them, that's important to them. And by the way, trying to tie their language back into it. So if they said, we want to make sure that she doesn't get spoiled. By the way, this, if you're not picking up, this is a common theme, right? But you're not, they said, we don't want to spoil her. You're like, hey, this isn't about avoiding probate. This isn't about controlling assets. Ultimately, this is about providing for your granddaughter in a way that's easy and seamless for her so that she's not spoiled one day, right? Subtle difference, but you're tying the recommendation back to something that's important to them and not trying to logically explain the legal and technical reasons for the recommendation. And that's another way that you ignite this motivation, is tapping into the why behind doing what they're doing.
So it seems to dovetail nicely with number seven, which is to move from being an advice giver to a thinking partner.
Yep. Hopefully they all dovetail somewhat together. But yeah, that one I think is pretty, it doesn't require much explanation, but I think there's this shift going on where in the industry, advisors are moving away from being advice givers and towards being thinking partners. So the model historically has gone, client comes in, you diagnose what's going on with them, and then you prescribe the solution. Diagnose, prescribe, retire at 65, here's your financial plan. What I think we're moving towards and moving to is this a transition to diagnose, still diagnose in the beginning, discuss, and then decide together. So you're no longer the authoritarian, the one making the decision. You help diagnose, you discuss the options together, and then you help them make the decision that's best for them, right? And so it's in this dynamic, it's the advisor's not the hero anymore. The advisor's the guide, the thinking partner, the collaborator, the facilitator. And it, for a number of reasons we can't get into now, it makes for better outcomes for clients. It creates a better relationship. But we're already starting to see that trend to happen, I think, a little bit. But I think that's where we're moving towards even more so, like, as we go on into the future.
So, you know, I interviewed Amy Mullen earlier today. She had this great line in our conversation that was, advice kills conversation, right?
Yeah, yep.
Advice kills conversation. And I think that's so true. And in some ways you're like, what the heck? Like, I'm a financial advisor. What do I do if I don't, like, what do I do if I don't give advice?
Right.
There's this very human tendency to push back against an authoritarian sort of command, right? If
right.
Sort of commanded to do something without our input and without conversation, we're not all that likely to do it. Quick plug, free course on the Orion Advisor Academy called Communicating with Empathy that goes into the science of this a bit and talks about it and talks about some of the things we've just discussed. The next one is tap into money memories. And I love the way you frame it here. It's just one of those simple things that I'm going to really take with me. You say that in the profession, we talk mostly about the present with the eye to the future, right? Like, okay, what's your current financial state? Where do you want to go? But we don't give any real focus to the past. Talk about how we can unearth the past, bring it into the conversation, and what impact it might have.
Yeah, so hang on, I got to pause on this real quick and go right back to the one before about giving advice and how if you tell somebody what to do, often it creates the opposite behavior. So some of you may remember this, but a number of years ago, there was this thing going on online on social media where, called the Tide Pod Challenge. And so in the Tide Pod Challenge, do you remember this?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, all right. So the Tide Pod, and fill in the gaps if I'm missing anything, but it's like basically they had these kids, these teenagers out there, people out there, that were essentially eating Tide Pods, which is, it doesn't take us rocket scientists to know that you're probably not going to feel very well afterwards. And there's even a good chance you might die. And so people are actually dying, getting poisoned from this. So they decided that they were going to have Rob Gronkowski, the former tight end from the Patriots, come on with his personality being what it is and say, guys, don't eat Tide Pods. Come on. And they thought, hey, we spread the message not to eat Tide Pods. That'll help it die down. Well, it actually spiked because they told people what not to do. And when we're told what to do, well, they told them not to eat it. But anytime we're told what to do by some other figure, our natural reaction oftentimes is to do the opposite. And so that spiked. So, and it's a silly example, but the same thing applies to giving advice to somebody. If you tell somebody what to do, they don't just naturally say, oh yeah, great point. That's what I need to go do. So sorry, anytime I talk about that or that comes up, I can't help but mention that because it's such an outrageous example.
No, I love it. One more example. We got to nerd out on all our studies today. So the Cialdini book has this great example of a similar concept where he talks about how all this wood was being stolen from this petrified forest. There was a petrified forest sort of national park, and people were taking little bits of petrified wood from this park. And so they had signs up everywhere that was like, you know, thousands of pounds of petrified wood is stolen every year from park guests, like, stop taking the petrified wood. And it sort of plays on these two behavioral biases. One is it's almost like giving permission. You know, when you're saying that, like, thousands of pounds of wood, it's sort of social proof. It's like, wow, all these other people are doing it. Like, I had no idea. Like, all these other people are doing it. I should be doing this too. And so, like the Tide Pods, you know, the combination of showing that all these other people are doing it and then commanding you not to is actually the worst thing you could do. They showed that these little signs in the petrified forest dramatically ticked up the rate at which the wood was stolen because of these sort of dual psychological impulses of social proof and bucking an authoritarian trend. So yeah, you've got to be this thinking partner and this collaborator and not a dictator.
Yeah, human beings are fascinating creatures.
It's true.
All right, back to money memories. Sorry, that was a little side note we had to go there. Yeah, I think the way I think through this, and I've heard other people say it too, is when you're meeting with a client, you're meeting with them right now in the present. But what you have to remember is that the client that you're meeting with today is not just the one you're meeting with today. It's the person that they're going to be 20 years from now. And it's the person that they were 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago sometimes. And So we're not going to hit on the future part. We've already done that a little bit with the Vivid Vision and the future self. But what we mean when we say it's not just the client today, it's the client that they were 20, 40, 60 years ago. What that means is that oftentimes our experiences from the past inform the way that we're interacting with money in the present. So the behaviors that you're presenting, the decisions that you're making may seem irrational. They may seem like they don't make sense. They don't add up. But oftentimes what you find is it can be traced back to an experience that you've had in your past. And that you learn from that. You took what you learned from that and you created this rule moving forward where you go, hey, this is now informing the way that I make decisions. So for example, when you see a client that comes in that has $1 million in cash, they haven't invested a dollar of it ever in their entire life. They've got a million, maybe a little bit much. Well, it's called five, it doesn't matter. They have too much money in cash. And you're sitting there telling them, hey, take a big portion. You only need $100,000 in cash. Take the other $900,000, $400,000, put it in the market, get a better return, and you build this portfolio for them. And they're not actually doing it. They're not following through to do it. Well, it's not because they don't get it. It's probably because if you spent the time to, well, I shouldn't say like that. It's not that easy to do. But if you had a chance to peel back the curtain, what you'd find is that this client growing up, in her early teens, spent a considerable amount of time sleeping in the car with her family on cold nights, bundled up in blankets in the back of the car because they couldn't afford to pay their mortgage. And so her thought is, hey, I don't want to invest this money because I'm going to do everything I possibly can to avoid that situation for my family in the future. And I'm not going to put anything at risk that could take that away. The market could take that away, but if it's in cash, I'll never have to relive that and I'll never force my kids to live through that experience, right? So you're dealing with the person in the present. Their behaviors don't make sense. And you're thinking, well, I can't get them to do this. Well, oftentimes it comes from something that's from the past because the past informs our decisions and behaviors in the present. And I think most importantly, so a lot of advisors get caught up on, okay, what do I do with that? It's just helpful to know that that's a thing. It creates some empathy and some grace when you realize that there probably is a good reason why they're not acting optimally.
So, you know, the way that I put this is that resistance always has a purpose. I think a lot of times when we, back to a why, right? When we encounter resistance from a client, I think oftentimes our first impulse is to be annoyed, you know, to wonder why they're, you know, why they're being hard-headed or why they're being obnoxious or whatever. Resistance always has a purpose, especially in a case like you said, where it's like, yeah, the financial reality, if it's pretty cut and dried, you'd be making more money if you did X. If they're refusing to do X in light of their sort of knowledge that that's a good thing, there's some psychological roadblock that underpins that. And once you can understand it, it usually crumbles, right? And you don't even have to fix it.
Yeah, yeah.
You just have to articulate it, highlight it, and know that it's there. And when you put some sunlight on it, it typically dissolves. But until you put some sunlight on it, it's going to continue to hamstring your process.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of power in just shining the light on it, right? I think that's one of the most freeing and empowering things I've learned from this money memory thing is, and financial flashpoints, these experiences around money, is you don't have to necessarily cure. In fact, most people probably aren't equipped to do that. But just even being able to raise the awareness and shine a light on it, first of all, it's the first step, but it can also be a powerful one where you don't even have to do anything from that point, right? It sort of, like you said, crumbles just by shining the light on it.
Yeah. So our penultimate rule here is to design for the plan, optimize for the person. And you quote Natalie Taylor, a former guest, friend of the show. Go listen to her episode on my podcast and yours. Wonderful guest. But Natalie says, I'd rather give advice that gets 80 to 90% of the results with 50% lift on their end than advice that's 100% optimal that never gets implemented.
Hmm. Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes of all time. And it's funny because so she said it on the show. I think she kind of said or talked through it on yours as well. And then like not too long after that, Kitsis and Carl are talking about this idea of, wait a minute, should we give 100% optimal recommendations or should we think about what's actually doable and what's implementable, right? And so that's something that she said that stuck with me for a long time. And here's the example that I always give to try to paint the picture or bring it home in a way that makes sense. So We have a friend, my wife and I have a friend who used the Noom app, N-O-O-M. It's the psychologically based weight loss app. Yeah. So it's in fact, it has a lot of financial planning parallels. You go in and just to make it simplistic, you say, hey, I weigh 200 pounds today. I want to weigh 180 pounds and I want to weigh 180 pounds in the next 6 months. Right. That's kind of like the gist of it is, yeah, tell us where you are. Tell us where you want to be. Let us know the time frame and we'll formulate this plan for you. Now, it has this, it has great psychological insights that are built into it and everything. But at its core, that's essentially what it's doing. It's saying, here's where you are. Here's where you want to be. Here's your path to get there. A lot like financial planning. Here's where you are today. There's where you want to be. Here's the plan to get there. Well, our friend goes in, does this, says, I'm 200, want to be 180 in 6 months. And Noom comes back and spits out this perfectly rational, 100% optimal recommendation that says, great, perfect. If you want to do that, all you have to do is eat 1,100 calories a day. Simple as that. Eat 1,100 calories a day. You'll be there in 6 months. It'll be easy peasy. No problem, right? And it's like, if you've ever looked at calorie counts before, you can go order a salad at a restaurant and get 1,100 calories in one salad. Eating 1,100 calories a day is really, really hard to do, especially if you're coming from 2,000. You're trying to cut your calorie count in half, but it's hard no matter what. And so while that's perfectly optimal advice, perfectly rational advice, it's just not reasonable. It's not doable. So what happens is that something that our friend could stick to? No. So that becomes not, it gets 100% of the result, but it takes way too much effort. Right. And so I think that's what we need to start thinking through in conversations with clients where we're making recommendations, providing advice. Is the recommendation that we're making actually doable on their part? Do they see it as something that's reasonable and that they could do? Or do we need to adjust and design for the person? Right. So the example I think of a lot is this guy that emailed me who said that they had a client who had $60,000 in a savings account. Their math, their spreadsheets had said, hey, you only need $30,000 in this account. Why don't we take this other $30,000, pay off the house, to put it in the market, do something better with it? Well, 3 years go by. They tell her every year to do it. She still hasn't done anything, still has $60,000 in the account. One of the advisors decided he was going to ask her, like, hey, how do you feel about the idea to put $60,000 in the account? She said, to reduce it from 60 to 30. And she said, honestly, it makes me uncomfortable because my late husband told me that once we had $60,000 in the bank, that's when we knew we'd be okay. And it's like, whoa. Well, of course she's not moving her money. And then imagine not feeling heard or understood. You're just pounding your away at this idea of, hey, take $30,000 and put it in here. Use to get a better use out of it. And that was perfectly rational, but it wasn't doable because she didn't want to do that, right? And so it took 3 years to finally get to that point. You can get there a lot sooner if when you give advice, you just ask the person, like, how does this feel to you? Does this feel doable on a scale of 1 to 10? How confident do you feel that you can do this? And you'll learn a lot that way, and you won't run into as many implementation problems down the road where you sit there and you go, why haven't they done what we've asked them to yet?
Yeah. Yeah. No, again, every bit of resistance has a purpose. She's
right.
She's not being obstinate. She's not being willful. Like, she's operating on a deeply personal experience that's informed her financial worldview and should be respected. Right.
Right. Right.
Last one. So we're gonna pump up your podcast today. We're gonna pump up your follower numbers. You're a great follow on social media, LinkedIn and Twitter. And you know, the thing that I see you post more about, again, anecdotally, the thing that I see you post more about than anything else is this sort of time of possession idea, right? This idea that we're talking too much in our meetings with clients. And so your last rule is don't forget the most important skill in financial advice. Tell us about this.
By the way, I'm totally ripping off the time of possession thing from you. So that I don't think I've ever called it that or looked at it that way. But hey, I guess I should get permission. Is that cool?
If I rip it off, ahead. I rip off the broad concept and I've been calling it time of possession.
Well, I love that. I think that's great. Yeah, I mean, okay, so when I was giving the presentation down at Shift, it was funny. To your point about that seems to be what I talk about a lot or the most. So I was up there. This is the last point, right? And I said the slide says the most important skill in financial advice. And I was like, all right, does anybody want to guess what the most important skill is in financial advice? And like without fail, the room, it was like an echo. Everybody was like, listening. And I was sat there. I couldn't have been more proud in that moment. I was sitting there going, In fact, I didn't believe them. I thought I'd accidentally skip forward a slide or something. I was like, how did you guys know this? Like, what do you mean? So anyways, I guess it's on brand. Yeah, and so I've been thinking a lot about this. And it's kind of funny, like, how do you articulate, how do you tell somebody that it's so powerful to listen, why it's so powerful to listen? Because here's what I think is funny is anybody who's ever been listened to and listened to intimately, listened to deeply, listened to by somebody that's genuinely interested and curious in what you have to say and is connecting with you on that, you don't need an explanation of why it's so powerful. You felt why it's so powerful. And so if you don't believe in the power of listening, you've probably never had that experience. In fact, when I work with some of the work that I do with advisors, that's one of the things that we do is we create that experience for each other so they can know what it feels like to be on both ends of the conversation. And you sit there and you're like, that is powerful. And the problem is that most people don't have somebody in their life that really actually truly listens to them. And when you do, those become your people, the people that you trust more than anybody else. So, I mean, it's so funny. Like, how do you talk about it? How do you quantify it? I don't know. But when you know, right? Nobody denies that they want to be heard and understood by somebody. Maybe the other way to think about it is anytime, if you've ever gone to hung out with somebody and you walk away from the conversation and you're like, hey, I really like that person. Like, I feel like that was a good conversation. We hit it off. I want to hang out with them again. Well, if we had a recording of that conversation, we went back and broke it down. I'm about 99.9% positive that you talked more than they did, because what we know is that when you talk about yourselves, it lights up the reward centers of the brain. So you walk away thinking, man, that was a great conversation. That person was great. I really liked him. And they didn't even have to say that much. They just showed a genuine interest in you. And so what that does is, like, I talk a lot about trust being the foundation of success in financial advice. Like, you're not going anywhere in this business if you can't build and establish trust. Well, listening is a skill that accelerates trust and likability along with asking questions. So that's why it's so important. And then if you want to look at data, like Dr. Moira Summers wrote Advice That Sticks. She says that the number one predictor of success in an initial meeting with somebody is the amount of airtime they get. And so there's all these things that are stacked in favor of it. And so but ultimately it's like, this isn't rocket science. The problem is it's just not easy to do. And it's not something that you can just go and say, hey, I'm going to be a better listener, and then walk in tomorrow and it just automatically happens. Now, that's part of it. You have to at least be aware. But the simplest, easiest thing you can do to try to up your listening skills tomorrow, it starts by reframing it and taking a different approach, having a different mindset, and just go in. And I may have even said this last time. I've said it all the time. I say it all the time because it's what I've found to be the most powerful way. Go in saying, hey, I'm going to listen 80% of the time. I'm only going to talk 20%. Right? So time of possession, 80-20. You're going to find that it's really hard to do. You're probably not going to hit it. You'll probably land 60-40, 70-30, maybe. If you talk a lot, you may not even get there. And that's fine too. But the idea is just go in with the mindset that you're going to do more listening than you do talking. And what's funny is you'll see people that kind of walk out and they're like, thanks. That was a great conversation. That's the best conversation I've had with somebody about money. And you're like, wait, I didn't even get to tell you how great my firm is, or the process is, or how many years I've been in the business, or all the other clients that I've helped like you. So once you do it, you see it. But you can't really know the power until you've seen it or experienced it firsthand.
So what I love about these rules is it just gives simple, practical things for us to attend to. So for the folks listening to this, and I mean, heck, whether you're an advisor or just think about it during your next conversation with a friend or with a spouse or whoever, attend to that time of possession metric. Really think about that. And try and be on, you know, you're not going to sit there with a stopwatch, but try and give it a rough approximation, right, of how much you did or didn't monopolize that conversation and see how it goes. And I think you're going to find that what he's talking about and what Dr. Summers wrote about is really true. So how about this for a slide? I'm envisioning a slide. We have joint ownership of this now. And it says, listening leads to likability. That's like a slide, big letters. Listening leads to likability, something to keep in mind.
Yes, yes.
As you go into your next meeting. So I'm going to give a little challenge here as we close up, because I actually wrote this down early in the conversation. You know, the great scientist and thinker Richard Feynman wrote about, he called it teaching about toilets, right? So, you know, you would ask someone, hey, do you know how a toilet works? And the average person says,
yeah, of course.
I know how a toilet works. And he's like, hey, great, explain it to me. And then we realize that we use the toilet a couple of times a day and we have no idea how it works. So, you know, presumably the listeners to this podcast are fans of, you know, the behavioral finance, human side of money, financial psychology, whatever. I would encourage you to do what Brendan did, which is to write down your sort of 10 commandments of human first advice. What does this look like for you in your practice? What is your this I believe? It's a challenge I've given myself because I think it's a really powerful thing to distill down as simply as possible what you think elicits change, what you think moves the needle for clients. Brendan, if people want to learn more about you and your work, your podcast, where can we find you?
Yeah, so I'll first of all, I love the challenge idea. Second of all, just from a behavioral perspective, like sometimes when I hear 10 things, I'm like, I need to carve out like an hour to distill all that. So even if you just sat there and did 5 things, right, like that's going to be powerful. And then like what I did was I had a list that didn't start at 10. I had a list and I just kept adding to it till it got to 10. And then now it got to 11. I had to trim it back down, right? But that's like if I had just waited till I had 10 ready to go, I'm not sure this would have ever come about, right? So don't let that number intimidate you. Yeah, okay, so the podcast is The Human Side of Money. The website's wiredplanning.com. We send out a newsletter once a month where it's like, hey, here are the best articles, podcasts, and videos on behavior, psychology, and communication with thoughts on how to actually use it or apply it with clients, right? Back to what the whole mission of this thing was. And Daniel's appeared in there multiple times. This podcast and the articles you've written have been in there. So thank you for that. And then, yeah, like you said, I'm pretty active on both LinkedIn and Twitter, and love interacting with people on there.
Great. Beautiful. This has been an excellent conversation. And it's all because I didn't talk much. So thank you for
Yeah. See, I'm sitting over here going like, man, this is great. Daniel's the man. I got to do this again because I just talked the whole time. So my brain's just firing on all cylinders.
I'm joking. Well, hey, man, thanks for coming on. Go Cards, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.